Hello, everybody. Welcome to a new episode of Open Science Radio, this time number 58. It's Monday, October 17th, 2016. And today we have a very, very special episode. But first, hi, Matthias. Are you good?
Yeah, as usual, I'm fine.
Excellent. Today we're not alone, actually. Today we have the great pleasure, the great honor to be joined by some other podcasters, and not anybody, but it's actually from PLOSCast, so another open science, open access focused podcast. And with us is Elizabeth.
Hi.
And Jennifer.
Glad to be here.
Yes. Hey, and Jennifer is there as well.
Hello.
Hi there. Awesome. I mean, this is really awesome that we really came together today, because Elizabeth and me, we met in, I think it was May already. Yeah, it was in May when we met in Berlin, right, at the Wiki site. And I think you came up with the idea, hey, maybe we should do a podcast together. And the original plan was actually to do this right there in Berlin, but I couldn't make it. So we said at some point, okay, let's do this maybe remotely. And here we are. So
that's great
to
have. Go great internet.
Yay. 2016, internet is connecting people. Yeah. So here we are now. And well, after setting up everything now, I think we can talk about us, you, and what you're actually doing. So maybe let's start with a question about you guys. So what are you actually doing at PLOS, or maybe what is actually PLOS for the listeners who are not aware what PLOS is, which is, I guess, nobody. But still, let's give this explanation.
Sure.
First.
I'd be excited to let some listeners know about PLOS for the first time if they haven't heard of us. So PLOS is the Public Library of Science, which is a nonprofit open access science publisher, specializing especially in biology and medicine. And we're best known for our mega journal PLOS One, which is, I believe, still the largest journal, scientific journal in the world. And we have another suite of six additional journals. And yeah, basically, PLOS One celebrating its 10th anniversary this year. So we've been around for a while, one of the first publishers kind of proving that open access can work as a sustainable model. And so I'm certainly very proud to work here. And I should say, this is Elizabeth. And so, my name is Elizabeth Seaver, and I'm the host of PLOSCast, and I'm also a researcher at PLOS. At PLOS, I'm looking at basically meta science or meta research. I interview scientists. I also conduct surveys with scientists, and have done analyses looking at everything from peer review models to, different sorts of attitudes about open science. And basically, I have a PhD in psychology, and I'm applying that to scientists and scientific publishing. So I love operating in the meta world, and that's what we try and do on PLOSCast as well. And I can let our producer, Jen Leloup, introduce herself.
It's Elizabeth. Yeah, as Elizabeth said, my name is Jennifer Leloup, and I work with her on producing this lovely PLOSCast that we do on a monthly basis. I've been at PLOS for about 8 years, going on 9, and I started working on PLOS One and just worked my way through there. And now I head up the editorial media team here at PLOS, where we focus on distributing and sharing all of the interesting research content that we publish on a daily basis. And that's pretty much what I do in a nutshell.
Awesome. Yeah, I actually still remember when PLOS One was announced, and this was really, it's amazing that this is already 10 years ago, and I think it made now a great history. And I think, well, it's the biggest journal in the world, if you think in numbers. And this is really amazing. This is really a great job. And also the mission by PLOS, actually having everything open access and being actually the pushing player in that game and really innovate the whole field dramatically. This is really awesome. It's really great that this is now already taking or going on for 10 years. And
it's been an amazing transformation over the last 10 years, really. I mean, I remember when we started, people would say, who is Plus One. What is this journal? Mm-hmm. And now everybody seems to really know the journal and have a lot of positive feelings towards it and the mission and what it's trying to do. So mm-hmm. It's been neat to see how that's evolved over the years and how quickly it's taken off. So. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's so well that it's even copied in several places now, right? I mean, in the beginning, mm-hmm. all the publishers said, this is just poor quality and so on. And now every big publisher is having something like this and basically is building on your innovation regarding this. So this is really, really great sign that you are very successful with that.
Yeah, I think copying is a huge form of showing success in an area. We really have shown that open access is a sustainable business model, and we have lots of other colleagues out there that agree.
Yeah, I figured we really made it once the for-profit publishers set up their own open access mega journals. We know they were crunching the numbers.
sure. Yes.
But overall, I think it's really helped science. I think that's what we're all here for and why we really want to see this work.
Definitely. And yeah, it's been really cool. You know, in my home field of psychology, you know, I went from, you know, when I was in graduate school, I didn't even really know what open access was. I just remember hearing about PLOS One because my lab mate wanted to publish it and her advisor was like, oh no, I don't think that's like a real journal. Meanwhile, she's published about 3 or 4 papers in PLOS One since then.
I think there's really a change in mind regarding this, and people accept that this is a proper journal, that there is, let's say, filtering regarding quality in that sense, but not regarding impact. And this is, I guess, the important message that science, even smaller stories, have to be shared, and that this is an important feature to science, that every voice is heard if the quality is right. And I think this is really done at PLOS One. Yeah, really nice.
No, and it's a great platform to let the community to decide. I mean, we're making sure it's quality, but the community is deciding what to really follow and share and grow from.
Exactly. You just had a recent episode about altmetrics, and there was clearly said, right? I mean, the journal impact factor is just so wrong and so bad. And we had this discussion in Open Science Radio so often. The journal impact factor is just not a metric we should use. And as you said, this the community itself should basically decide on a article basis what is important and what not, and not just where it's published, basically.
Yeah, absolutely. That's why PLOS pioneered article level metrics. You know, when you have a mega journal, you know, part of the idea is that if you're publishing all sound science, journal metrics don't really mean the same thing when you have such a high volume, so many different fields, and to really, you know, drill down into, you know, do right by the authors. You need to go down to the article level to really understand.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. By the way, do you know how large PLOS is right now? I mean, how many employees are there? Do you have any numbers in your head?
Wow. I don't want to be off because we have two offices, one in the U.S., one in Cambridge. And then we also have a lot of people who work outside of PLOS. I mean, if you want to consider like editorial boards, you know, I mean, anybody who is working for PLOS, either in a volunteer capacity or, you know, part-time or full-time, it's a lot of people.
Yeah. Well, I'd say like in terms of employees, I think we're around, is it two?
Yeah. 200 employees and 7,000-ish editorial board members.
Wow. Okay. That's huge indeed. Yeah. And how much of this does PLOS One make, and which parts are going to the other journals like PLOS Computational Biology, PLOS Biology, and so on? Do you know this roughly?
So both Jen and I are actually, you know, not on any particular journal. Mm. So there are a decent number of PLOS employees who are just PLOS. Mm. I'm not sure how many there are in each journal specifically. Okay. There's, you know, people in editorial, obviously, and then publishing services. I don't know what the numbers are.
Yeah, I don't have the exact numbers.
But at some point you thought, hey, there is a need maybe for a different format of how to talk about open access and all the things connected to this. And then you just came up with PLOSCast. Or what is your process of what is your the history basically to start PLOSCast as an alternative to, I guess, basic blogging or something like this? What is the aim of PLOSCast?
Oh, that's interesting. So I can say that for me, the immediate impetus was, you know, as a researcher at PLOS, I was, you know, learning so many cool things about, you know, especially open science and, you know, the effects of open access and, you know, the implications of open access, you know, as we sort of proven that model, what does that mean? What other, you know, benefits to science does that enable to have this corpus, you know, freely available to everybody? And as I was exploring these things and, you know, primarily doing internal research at PLOS, you know, I remember thinking, I'd really like to share this with other people. And I'd really like to talk about this, you know, these sorts of issues. I felt like I knew a decent number of podcasts that would, you know, say things like Science Friday, which is a fantastic podcast, but that's more about, you know, the specific research topics in science. And I sort of was like, I want to do something, you know, right, big picture that regardless of research field, that people who are involved in science and research, you know, at universities, research institutions, or just, you know, big science nerds, that there'd be a place for them. And in terms of why not blog posts, I think talking's easier. It's easier than writing.
I completely agree. This is why I also prefer podcasting, actually. Yeah, but Elizabeth, you said this basically that you kind of want to represent your research inside of PLOS in PLOSCast. So what is maybe you can describe a little more what you're precisely doing at PLOS and what your role is and how you put this into PLOSCast.
Most of what I've been doing thus far. So PLOSCast right now, we've been primarily in interview format. So I'll have a guest on the show and either, you know, we'll host them here at PLOS or connect remotely to talk about, you know, often the work that they're doing. So most of what I've done thus far has been just having conversations with some of the people I've been talking to, such as yourself, Conrad, you know, meeting at conferences and talking about this stuff. I feel like, you know, there's a really sort of cool, you know, community in science publishing and open science. But, you know, for the average scientist, they don't have access to it in the same way. And they might not know some of these things that, you know, become sort of second hat. You're like, oh yeah, you know, my fifth force 11 or whatever, you know, like, sure, I know all about article level metrics, but, you know, some scientists, might not know about this. So I do know that some of our listeners, are practicing scientists who hopefully are getting something out of thinking about this, again, like kind of bigger picture of science.
No, I completely agree. This is a very helpful, even for me, who I would say is an active scientist and is already rather deep in this. Still, several of your episodes really were really delivering a lot of very helpful information that I was not aware of before. So I think that's a very nice
that's
one.
Great.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, I'm really can recommend listening to this as a great source, because you really talk to people who are so deep in this, like in Alan Cameron and so on. So it's really, I get a great source, and it's really, I think, part of or is well aligned with PLOS mission, basically to open up these kind of things, and even the whole open science approach, actually bring this to people, and you're not covering only open access and so on, so basically the whole range of what one consider as open science today, right? Even let's say the recent one, for example, altmetrics and so on.
Yeah. And, you know, so yeah, we've covered lots of different topics from, you know, the career struggles of postdocs in biology, and how we're, you know, we're producing PhDs faster than we can make faculty positions for them, and you know the ramifications of that. We also have talked about scientific data management and tools that are helpful for that, and just the kinds of struggles that scientists often have with managing their data. Right, altmetrics, as you said, and that even the history of science publishing. Talking with that was Aileen Fife about that, and right, and with Cameron, that was sort of a wide ranging interview about the significance of peer review and journals, and he's gone in really a sort of interesting humanities direction in his own work now. I don't know if you've been following his work since he became a professor at Curtin.
Exactly, because because he went basically out of science for a while and then started science in a completely different field. This is kind of interesting CV that he has to do this in a way. Yeah. Mm.
He's probably also one of these persons that is kind of hard to interview, not because he's not a nice guy, he probably is, but because he can talk about so much that you really have to stick to kind of maybe some thin red line that you want to stick thematically to, otherwise you're just dropping from one issue to the other, and he can probably talk endless about this stuff.
Yeah, I mean, we did have two full episodes of the interview.
Right.
Because he had a lot to say. Oh yeah, Cameron is a wonderful person, a wonderful interview, and yes, definitely has thoughts about a lot of different things in science. Like that's why it was so great to talk, because he just thinks so deeply about these things.
Yeah. Elizabeth, as a psychologist, I mean, and this is basically there's no, let's say, default path from studying psychology and being. Well, what is your job title actually in PLOS, right? I mean, being what you're doing here in PLOS, what was your path there? This is also not a clear and straightforward CV, right?
Although it was technically a pretty fast transition from grad school to PLOS, yeah, it's maybe not completely obvious. So I think technically my full job title is contributor experience researcher. And contributor experience, or CXP, is the internal department that I'm in, focused especially on authors, editors, and reviewers, but also staff support as well. Mm-hmm. I can say that with my psychology degree, my PhD is in developmental psychology. I was doing studies with 4 and 6 year olds. And the thing I like to say is that, surprisingly, the interview techniques that you use on 6-year-olds are basically the same as when you talk to scientists. So if you can keep a 6-year-old's attention, you can keep anybody's attention.
Okay, good to know. And
I
guess
can be either very flattering now or very disturbing for some interview guests.
Yeah. I could.
Well, yeah. I'm thinking more of my research interviews than podcast interviews, because with interviewing kids, you're trying to make sure that everything is easily understood, and that when they're answering questions that you've said exactly what you mean. And so it kind of encourages this sort of precision. You have to be so careful with developmental research, because, if you use one big word, then, right, the 6-year-old might look at you and be like, I have no idea what you just said.
But it's probably true for all of these interviews that you have to kind of ask questions as simple but as detailed as you would like to, but as simple as possible. So in order to have all your listeners in podcasts, for example, or maybe all your readers in written interviews, be part of this journey and not drop out somewhere in between because they don't understand even the questions.
Right. It's
I was just going to say, I think effective communication is important, and being succinct in questions that allow for, like you were saying, audiences from all different locations or backgrounds to really understand you helps you make a really useful podcast. Mm-hmm. Hope.
Yeah. And it is also interesting that, there's sort of the, of course, I'm going to be aware of this as a psychologist, but, things like the curse of knowledge, that basically it if you know things, it's much harder to put yourself in people's shoes who don't. So I feel like a lot of times when I am interviewing people for the show specifically, in the back of my mind, I'm trying to think about, while they're talking, you know, would a regular scientist understand this? Would, you know, my lab mates and my friends, if they heard this, would they know what that abbreviation meant? Or they know like about this general thing? And so like, that's one thing that's, you're in danger of, I think, is using jargon that people wouldn't be familiar with. I mean, science is bad enough with jargon, but you know, science publishing has its own kinds of jargon. So, you know, PLOS thinks in terms of ALMs. But it's helpful to say, actually spell out article level metrics for people who aren't living and breathing this stuff all the time.
Mm. You mentioned a couple of minutes ago something about your listeners. And something that we constantly try to get our heads around is who actually listens to us. So maybe you can lose a couple of words on whom you might address and whether you have a feeling or whether you even maybe know who your actual target group is.
Well, so I can say that our target group are people who are interested in science and science publishing, probably largely, you know, grad students and other researchers, but really, you know, also people who are interested in the process of science. And so my goal is to reach people who are interested in thinking about this bigger picture, you know, like the kinds of conversations we used to have in my lab all the time. That's what I think is cool that I get paid for now. That when I'd be procrastinating, you know, my dissertation, and I would, you know, talk to my friends about, you know, either how, you know, we were having difficulty applying for certain grants, or how, you know, there were certain just, you know, kind of structural issues with, you know, academia that we would discuss. And now I get to do that for my actual job. So that's pretty cool.
Getting paid for procrastination. Yeah.
it was kind of surprising for me to actually discover that PLOS is offering a podcast. The first couple of episodes, like 7, 8, 9, I don't remember correctly, were totally not in my timeline. And I was like, what? There's a podcast? I can't believe. I mean, and I'm probably not the only one, because everything in PLOS is kind of obvious, but hidden at the same time. And sometimes it's really difficult to find your way through through this vast universe of topics and subjects and articles and journals and all this to what you actually want to read or listen to. And do you have any kind of idea how people stumble upon your podcast? Do they come from one of the journals, or is it indeed more a community thing?
That's a really good question. And I think we didn't know exactly where everybody was going to come from, but we did do a few things with regard to distribution, such as posting the PLOScast on SoundCloud, for instance, and attaching that to iTunes, Apple iTunes, so we can get a broad audience that way. We also use our blog platform, our PLOScast blog, and Twitter, which has a huge following for us. And we just, I guess, started the PLOScast, set it up on the blog and SoundCloud, and just kind of hope from there. But we have some stats. So last year we started when we started the PLOScast, I think it's been a year. It's been a year.
Yeah, I think it has been
a year. So we have some stats. We had, over this last year, we had over 8,000, almost 9,000 views, plays. So we're averaging about 750 viewers per month, which is great. Our top five countries, we weren't surprised about the U.S. being the number one. But Germany is number two. United Kingdom is number three. Canada is the fourth, and Australia is the fifth. Our top cities, I find this so interesting. San Francisco, Würzburg, Germany,
Then we have, really?
Yeah, and then we have Brookline, Massachusetts, Toronto, Canada. And rounding out the top five there is London.
Crazy.
In the UK, yeah.
That's kind of surprising. I would mm-hmm. never have guessed that Germany is, listeners-wise, at least on the second place.
Yeah, we wouldn't have either. I would have thought for sure San Francisco and then maybe Cambridge and London. But it's a good surprise.
Yeah, cool.
Indeed.
Thank you, Germany. Yes. We love you.
Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, it was kind of, when we stumbled upon the podcast, it was kind of, we have to get the word out. And mm-hmm. So we Twittered and mentioned it here and there. And you can see that people were responding like, oh yeah, there is a podcast, cool, I have to retweet this. And I actually stumbled upon a tweet from one of your guests, I think it was Matt or Eileen, I can't remember for sure. So that's probably also something that one can build upon, that the interview guests themselves might jump in and do mm-hmm. some advertising.
Yeah, we've been very lucky with our interview with Matt Shipman on how to communicate science. We had a pretty large sharing
I can
ecosystem
imagine.
There. It's now one of our top viewed episodes, actually.
But, oh, cool.
Yeah, we do rely a lot on our guests to help.
I mean, that's probably also a problem that is very, very common for a lot of scientists. I mean, how do I actually communicate the stuff that I'm researching and what's the best channels to explore? So that's probably an episode that helps quite a lot of people.
Yeah, and of course, somebody whose job is to help scientists, you know, translate their work into, you know, easy to understand simple sentences, that makes a great interview guest. I mean, I felt like every single thing he said was just so tweetable. It was hard to narrow it down, because we do try and share some, you know, quotes from the interviews, you know, when we tweet about it. And it was just like, wow, every sentence is golden and short and so well into 140 characters.
Yeah, I know. Mm-hmm. We had the same experience with Greg Wilson from the Software Carpentry. Mm-hmm. He has this attitude of, you're kind of a good communicator if you're a good teacher, or mm-hmm. some similar stuff, but he put it in much more sophisticated words. And you were also constantly, I was also constantly sitting there, and I have to write that down. I have to cite that somehow and put that into a tweet or something like that. So I can imagine how it was.
Pure wisdom.
Yeah. But mm-hmm. speaking of your interview partners, I mean, you said it in the beginning that the PLOSCast so far is more or less completely consisting out of interviews with a bunch of very interesting people. How do you, and Elizabeth, you also said it, that you meet a lot of these people on conferences and maybe workshops and all this kind of stuff. But how do you approach them? What do you tell them to, or how do you convince them to come to your show and be your guests?
Well, I'm lucky. I haven't had to work super hard at it. So I've approached people at conferences, and then you approached Matt Shipman about it, I think, at a SciComm conference. Well, normally I'll just reach out either by email or in person and say, you know, I'm doing a podcast for PLOS and we'd love to have you as a guest. And, you know, once we had the first few guests, then we could refer people to other episodes. So Cameron Nalon, our first guest, was still working at PLOS when we actually conducted that interview. So that was just really easy. It was like, who within PLOS would be a good interview? And really, I think that's the battle. Is like, once you have those first few, you can refer other people to them.
Yeah, true. Mm. And maybe the name PLOS rings a bell with a lot of people, and you probably have to put less effort, at least at this point, to tell them what you're actually doing, what it is that you're doing, and why you're hosting this podcast.
Yes, definitely. You know, it's great that PLOS has so much goodwill in the community, because, you know, people are pretty much universally positive and interested in doing it. So I've, Yeah, I've been super lucky with the people that we've invited. You know, there have been times where scheduling is hard, but I feel like everyone, you know, they want to, like, I'm trying to talk to people who are like already seriously, you know, nerding out to this stuff, right? And and really, really interested in meta research.
Yeah. Would you, or did you ever think about whether it would be different if you wouldn't be the PLOSCast, whether you would be just an Open Science Radio US? Would be, there be some difference, or would it be basically the same?
Well, so one thing that's nice about doing this at PLOS is that we have, you know, resources here, and yeah, we don't have any episode sponsors or anything like that right now. But like, for example, you know, with our equipment and stuff, it's been great that PLOS believes in the show and has been willing to support us. Cause, you know, we all have full-time jobs at PLOS, and in addition to the podcast. So I really think that that support is pretty helpful. And right, you know, and it opens doors as well because of, again, like I was saying, like PLOS's goodwill in the community. I don't know, Jen, do you have any other thoughts about that?
Yeah, I think I would agree. I mean, the fact that PLOS believes in the show and is supportive is a huge help. If we didn't have that, I would, you know, it would be really difficult to get the, you know, good recording equipment, for example, or sponsorships and also access to the community. It probably would take, I think it can be done. Well, you know, of course it can be done, but it would just take more time to ramp up, I would think. Well, tell us about you, actually. I mean, how has it been for you? How have you been able to grow your show?
It's been a long and rocky road so far. No, I mean, it's the podcast that we are doing, and I just start this, Conrad, and you may add afterwards. The podcast that we are doing has been there for, I think it's the fourth year. And it started as something different. It started as my therapy, you could call it. I blogged about open science and open access and all these kind of facets of open science for a while. And I couldn't believe that there wasn't a podcast around at that time talking about this, neither on open science nor on open access. And I would have guessed that there are at least 10 podcasts about open access, because the field was rapidly growing and getting more attention and becoming more and more important, also with politics paying attention to the open access movement. And I was so frustrated, because you couldn't block enough to put up all the good ideas out there and to put out the criticism to all the to all those folks not paying attention to these things. So I thought it would be much easier to just talk instead of writing it down, and because once you write things down, you tend to read it again and reformulate it. And I felt that, at least for me, it was better to directly tell my ideas and what I had in mind, instead of constantly reformulating it until it was diplomatically okay, but it wasn't as sharp anymore. And I felt that writing about this stuff lost a couple of those ideas that I had in mind, and a couple of those opinions that I had in mind. So I just sat down and recorded these episodes just by myself, wanting to give news and recent developments around this topic, and at the same time giving my opinion, which in the first like 8 or 9 episodes, it was a flop. To be honest, as you can imagine, it's, there much too many news out there, and it was kind of probably also very boring to listen to. So
I like Matthias. I like it, by the way.
So I thought, I want to do this as a dialogue, because having somebody who's responding to you and maybe even also telling you that your opinion in this, or that your ideas in this one thing are incorrect, or that you haven't thought about this properly, just to have a second opinion is probably something that is much more entertaining than just listening to one guy talking to himself. So I thought, why not asking around in the community if somebody wants to join me? Because it was also very... very time consuming to record for myself, because I was constantly putting the recording on pause and trying to repeat it, trying to get out proper sentences, something that I never pay attention to when I just talk to Conrad. And so Conrad was one of the guys responding to my blog post, asking if somebody wants to join. And from then on, we just did it as the two of us. And it was so much more feeling like it should be. And from then on, it was great. And we started to ask people if they want to come on the show and talk to us about their topics. I think like 1.5 years back, we also started to record English shows. It's always kind of difficult to record in a different language that isn't your mother tongue, because you might lose parts of the message due to just not being able to formulate your ideas correctly. But we thought, like, okay, this is not a German topic. This isn't even only a European or US topic. It's just a global topic. So we should pay more attention to international guests. And so we took the chance, and from there it just feels nice to be part of that podcast.
And it's still therapeutical, we have to say. I mean, it's just talking about all the trouble out there, and it's just good that you know at least another person is listening, right? And maybe some more, but at least one person is directly listening and responding and having the same feeling about it. And sometimes we just have these kind of our discussions, basically, and sometimes you have people invited and having a focus on a certain topic. And I think this is a nice mixture for us. Yeah. We can sometimes dive more deeper into certain topics or news. Sometimes they are not news anymore because we let them lie around for a while, but still important topics that we can discuss and shed more light on that. And I think this is also very nice. I personally, you know, Matthias is asking the right questions. This is really brilliant about him, so I'm enjoying this. And basically, this podcast is kind of a side effect of that. Huh? It's really... More the two of us talking, and well, whoever would like to join can listen to it.
Yeah. And it's nice that we're both coming from different backgrounds, Conrad being a scientist himself and me being not even in this scientific or research system anymore, just being somebody who's interested in all that and looking from kind of the outside. And at the same time, from an economic perspective. So that also brings up always two... islands that we're starting from, meeting somewhere in the middle.
Yeah.
Cool. What do you do now, Matthias, in addition to the podcast?
Pardon?
What do you do now in addition to the podcast?
Well, on a day-to-day basis, I just work in my profession, and the whole podcast recording and editing and also hosting, you know, this is what we do just in our free time. It's our free time activity. And we thought about a couple of times that we lose ideas about would it be good to have kind of an institutional roof to be under, like the Open Knowledge Foundation would be something that would kind of be appealing. But at the same time, it's always good to be just you, because then you at least you don't have somebody who you have to pay attention in terms of justifying anything. Kind of, why is the next episode taking so long? Or why did you only talk for 1.5 and not 2 hours about this topic? That's something that just gives a certain freedom.
Mm-hmm. Or why is your language so explicit, right? I mean, it's not that we're shouting all the time, but sometimes we are rather explicit regarding certain players in the game. So I think this is something or some freedom that you might not have if you're associated with the organization and it's just the two of us. I think this is at least our model, the model for us. And as Matthias said, we often thought about connecting to something, but we always decided against this because this is at least our way of doing that.
Yeah. Yeah, I can see how it might be tough. I think for us, we're really lucky, to be honest with you. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we have a good amount of editorial independence, and mm-hmm. I don't really have to self-censor, which mm-hmm. is nice.
We're all about transforming research communication. So when we get to talk to the innovators and leaders of different things going on around the space, we have a good solid standing to do mm-hmm. interviews. Mm.
Did you ever think about deviating from this interview path that you have gone so far for the 14 episodes, I think?
Yeah, we've been talking about, trying to release some episodes that are, more heavily edited and, drawing from potentially multiple interviews. So we might have some stuff in the pipeline for that. I don't want to make any promises now, but we were interested in trying to explore that. I mean, when I consume podcasts constantly, I love podcasts and, most of them have a much larger budget than we do. And I think, much more editing for each episode. And so there's a part of me that would sort of want to make something like, some of the shows that I love, like On the Media or Planet Money, I think those are both NPR, where they can dive into these topics and they also have more of an overarching narrative tying it together. I would love to do something like that. And so we'll see, we've got a good team here. It'll be ambitious, but I hope we can do at least a few episodes that are like that. But we also have some more interviews lined up, and we're planning to do some of that.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
That sounds good.
I think both is fine. Even if you would just sit together, the two of you, and talk about your daily business at Plus would be probably be interesting for a lot of people.
Oh my gosh, really?
But I can totally understand. I mean, that's something that we, from time to time, we wonder about who actually is our target group. And it is, so far as we know, it's so diverse that we can't actually start thinking about what would be the best content for the people that listen to us, because I mean, it's not only scientists, it's some are politicians, some are just the ordinary people as I am, not just being interested in science in general and in science communication, some being hardcore scientists or nerds and who always ask when are we bringing on the more technical topics again. So it's kind of really such a diverse group of people that, as I always feel, that properly reflects the community, which is kind of nice.
That's really cool. So how do you hear from your listeners? Do they tweet you? Do they email?
Yes. We have all the channels like Twitter. We're available via email. We have the comments section in the blog, which is used by some people, not very much. I would love to see more comments and actually a discussion amongst listeners. Not only addressing us, but addressing themselves and starting the discourse in the discussion in the comment section as well. Because I mean that's what it's all about: sparking ideas in people, telling them what's out there, and giving them a first step. And from there on, hoping that they will follow this as long as they're interested in developing their own ideas, developing their own opinions, and finally even taking actions, which would be the kind of holy grail that we would love to give, or that we would love to spark, that people actually take the step and take the risk, career-wise risk, to make their own science, if they are researchers, more open and start publishing open access versus in some closed access journals, start making not only their final product, the article, open, but their research data, start opening up their research process in terms of providing information about their methodologies and all these facets that open science involves. That would be so lovely if we would have this effect. And sometimes we hear about people responding to us, tweeting at us, or sending an email, or meeting some people in person, telling us, hey, it was so great to get to know about this new tool, and I explored it, and finally it dragged me into this direction, and now I'm publishing at PLOS or at some other open access journal instead of the usual journals. And that's always the best thing. That's kind of I can't think of a proper way of saying this in English, but there's a German saying, it's balsam für die Seele. Conrad, you might know the exact translation.
Oh, damn.
So it's what maybe really touches you.
Yeah, kind of a massage for your soul, or something. Oh, yes. Like this, maybe the closest that comes to my mind, but it's not like this. Yeah, but as an author, I guess the most feedback I personally got is actually at the meetings, right? If we because we have several open science meeting and things related to that, and often people come and I was listening to this and this was really helpful, maybe you can talk about this at some point. I think this is the one I personally get most, and it's also part of the podcasting scene. We have a, I think, rather active scene of scientific podcasters, not only with a focus on open science, but more in science in general, in people talking about their topics. And we have really funny people in this community, and there are some really hilarious podcasts out there that are so worth listening. And we kind of referring to each others, or we even invite each others to other things. So this is, I think, a very nice network, and we also get rather good feedback in general.
Ooh, that's great. And what are the aspects of open science that you mentioned open data? What are some of the other aspects of open science that you guys are most interested in?
Well, I myself, I'm a scientist myself, so I personally also try to make my research reproducible. So the whole process is kind of important. And for this, well, open source, I'm a bioinformatician, so I try to publish my code as well, and set also the little scripts that I use in order to come from the data that is located somewhere and should be also published as part of a publication. But, well, basically, I usually write a script that is downloading the data from, for example, NCBIGEO, does the processing, and in the end, you ideally have the figures at hand that are found in the paper. I've done this not for everything so far, but this is my aim, to really completely make this reproducible. And, well, this is easier said than done, because the issue is that, you know, software is changing platforms are changing. So this is definitely a hard thing, but still even trying and getting there is already much more helpful than just writing data not shown or in-house script used, whatever. So I think this is my personal perspective. This, as a bound mathematician, I try to make my research reproducible that other people can get to the same conclusions as I done, or even better, can correct me and find different paths or interpretations of something. This is my aim, at least.
Have you guys interviewed any librarians for your podcast?
Well, we have one on the radar. We shouldn't mention this, but it's on the list. Yes, we are in contact. We have different people in the community that have maybe a librarian background, and we, especially in the German scene, Lambert Heller is very pushing this forward. He's what is the name of this, Matthias? TAB.
It's actually called the Open Science Lab, and it's a technical university library that is financing this Open Science Lab as some kind of a task force to look into this open science movement and start developing useful applications and all these kind of things.
Cool. Yeah. The reason I asked about librarians specifically is, you know, this has been for me one of my biggest discoveries since graduate school. I wish I'd known how valuable university libraries are. And with some of the issues you were talking about, Conrad, especially, you know, data longevity and keeping, you know, being able to keep records that'll handle change over time and technology. This is something librarians have been focused on for a really long time. And, you know, like in terms of how can we, you know, make data as close to permanent as possible and easily findable and, you know, indexed in a helpful way. I've talked to a few librarians on PLOSCast and, or people with library backgrounds as well. And, I've just been really sort of like, wow, this is so, so important. And oh my gosh, I would have totally taken much more advantage of the fact that I had had a university library when I was a grad student if I had known that they could have helped me with my work.
Yeah. And they're becoming more and more important. Actually, they could become the backbone of this whole open science movement because they have they're looking into each and every part of open science from their perspective, and they could provide solutions and guidance and platforms and all this kind of thing. And they are so much more than just a collection of books in an old building. And
right,
yeah,
it's changing dramatically, right? I mean, as a librarian, you today need a completely different skill set than I guess 10 years ago. And I think this is really something, really a challenge for them as well to be aware of the new technologies, applying them, see what will fly, maybe what will not fly, and so on. I guess that this is a very interesting and challenging job today, but they are really important for the future of science.
Oh, absolutely. You know, with their own institutional repositories, and, you know, while PLOS is gold open access, meaning that, you know, the articles are, you know, under Creative Commons license CC BY and are available to use and reuse. You know, they, librarians have really pioneered, green open access, you know, just sharing, preprints and PDFs on your institutional repository. And that's been really helpful too for open access.
Where do we go from here? I was just in my mind, I was just going through the people that I know, and that I just thought, okay, if you drag one librarian in front of a microphone, you just can't drag one. You just have to interview a bunch of librarians, each from their own perspective and each in their own field offering the services that they're working on. So that'll be a very interesting podcast idea, actually.
Yeah, I'm sure they would love that too, the library community.
Yeah, true. One thing that I was that we're currently thinking about more or less loosely, but that you might also find interesting is the stuff that we are doing is basically talking or doing interviews about scientific topics. So it's not science itself, but it's kind of on the verge of it, and it's definitely very deeply connected to science. So what I always think about is how can we make this information that we're producing in these podcast episodes, and especially if you have a very highly experted guest, you're producing a very dense amount of information that is probably very valuable to a lot of people. How can we make this more explorable and more accessible for a bunch of people? Have you thought about what to do else than just publishing the interviews with this sort of stuff?
We do have a blog post for each episode.
Kind of also collecting all the show notes, as we call it. Right. So this links to the stuff that was talked about.
Right. And, just a little sort of, some context for the interview, a general summary for people who might be, who aren't already subscribed to us in their podcast client. I do actually know some people do listen to us through because the episodes are embedded in the blog post. Some people do just play them right in the blog post.
What do you say that if you're a researcher and a researcher is your guest and you have a full interview with him published in the podcast format, would you consider this as an outlet for the researcher himself? So would it be countable in something like Altmetrics?
That would be really cool. I don't know if maybe with the blog post some of that would get picked up. I think PLOS is article level, so if it's not tied to a DOI, I don't think it would go into PLOS's own metrics.
But we do have the media curation tool. So if we do put a link to a researcher's manuscript with a DOI, if you click on it, it should pick up the paper and attach it to the manuscript itself.
Okay.
Under the,
I wonder, it's possible that Altmetric might pick up our blog posts as well.
Yeah.
Not sure.
That you measure others.
Because that was something that we pretty early on thought about. Would it be possible to assign a DOI to a podcast episode and just have it counted as something like a publication itself?
That sounds great. I mean, I feel like it kind of depends on, the structure and format of a podcast. But I mean, if you're talking to scientists, that would make a lot of sense. I think in general, we've not really figured out good ways to reward scientists for doing outreach, other than maybe some additional lines in their on CVs. They're not tracked in the same way. I think, whether it's a TED Talk or a podcast interview or, newspaper articles. Even newspaper articles don't have DOIs.
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm.
Because we are thinking, since quite a while, we still need to implement this at some point. I just did once a small test, but in principle, we have Figshare, we have Zenodo. It's no big deal actually dumping an audio file or even audio file with some text there and use this as the identifier for it. And once you have a DOI, putting this or connecting this to your ORCID would be actually very easy. And then you have kind of a new measurement even regarding these outreach items, right? So why haven't we done this so far, Matthias?
I think the overall reason for, or the general excuse for everything that we haven't done, or for everything that we have kind of put into the future to do then, is our time budget, I think.
Yes, I think it'd be really cool to index podcast episodes that way. I also think, if you think about all the different ways that we share and excerpt text, I would love to see a lot better, just broad, with podcasts becoming like, they're so mainstream now that there's so many people listen to podcasts. I would love to see audio formats change where, there would be better, excerpting and, sharing like you do with an article or blocks of text. Because it's sort of hard to go to a specific spot in a podcast and, pick out a sound clip or, link to a certain place. I think that would also help a lot.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, indeed. Yeah, there must be much more like a proper standard for basically the different chapters and so on, that this is rightly adapted. And yeah, it's amazing, but I still disagree with you. I think it's not so, or podcasting or listening to podcasts, not as widely adapted as it could be, in my opinion. And I think especially scientists, I mean, I've talked to many, and not many or not a large fraction of them are listening to this, while this is such a great source. And I think there's a lot of room or a lot of space for improvement and a lot of potential for gaining more people. And hopefully with this, more technologies are implemented in order to make this easier and better.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I totally agree that, certainly in certain subject areas and like science, we have room for many more podcasts and many more listeners. I'm just thinking that now that, there's some of the top podcasts on iTunes get things like a million downloads, an episode. And, if there's some, money and business behind that, I would trust that they'd be able to do some innovations on that format that, might be harder for the kind of mom and pop type podcasts with less resources. Mm.
But even then, it's maybe it's, this is also a movement that is rather bottom up than top down. So maybe the innovation comes then from those who are not yet in the central focus of everybody. So that was something that I started to think in the beginning, kind of as a way to calm down before recording. I mean, who listens to this stuff? And it still is compared to a lot of, even to a lot of German podcasts that are significantly smaller than the big US podcasts. We're basically really, really, really small. I mean, it's statistics and analytics are always kind of hard. So what is the download? Yeah. And does somebody downloading the stuff, does it also mean that he has listened to it? If he started listening to it, does it mean that he has listened to it to the end? And there's also a lot of room of trying to get meta information out there. So, I mean, we have chapter marks in the podcast. What are actually the chapter marks that are listened to, or the chapters that I listen to per episode, and what's kind of the topical focus that is in the interests of our listeners?
And so, NPR, National Public Radio in the US, that I mentioned before, they actually have an app for their own podcast called, I think it's NPR One. And one of the reasons why they created their own app is they wanted to do exactly that. They wanted to track exactly how many people are listening to what, what are they even skipping in an episode if they're skipping ahead? How far do they get in before they abandon? And if you have the app environment, then you can get a lot more information about the user. Now, it's probably not practical for every, podcaster to develop their own enclosing app.
Right. But, Yeah. And this is kind of painful, right? That there is basically an open standard. Basically, you have a certain file formats, you have RSS and all these kind of things. And then going back to the basically locking this away in an app would be really a pity. But okay, NPR is a rather huge enterprise. And I can imagine that they have short interest in having this information. While for us, it would be very interesting to have it, but it's not our priority, right?
Right.
It's for us having fun and getting the message out.
Yeah. I don't know if it would actually change something, because I mean, we thought in the beginning about it, what would be of interest for our listeners, and then we just did what was in the interest of ourselves, and it probably right. has some parallel to all the listeners out there, and that was what I wanted to say initially. Then it was kind of helping to be more relaxed about recording this podcast, knowing that there are only like between 1,000 and 2,000 people listening to each episode, because it's compared to what's out there, how many people are in the system and in the sciences and dealing with this stuff. It's basically really, really, really small. But then again, it's 1,000 or 2,000 people who are really interested in this stuff, and maybe those are the ones that are more important than others in order to bring out the word and spread the idea further and kind of infect their colleagues, infect in a good way.
Yeah, I find when you think about these numbers, you know, right, if knowing that there are much bigger podcasts isn't super helpful. What I like to do is, for the numbers, is imagine all of them in a room with me and say, wow, that's a pretty big audience, if you just picture them all sitting right there. And also, you know, I feel very similar to you about podcasts. Like, this is stuff that I just intrinsically care about, and conversations, you know, the kinds of conversations that I was having with, you know, my grad student friends. And so there's that part of me that's just sort of hoping, you know, if I care about this, and it's, you know, there's hopefully other people who care too, who would want to listen.
Right.
And, my sort of metric for success is, if we look at the analytics, is there any way that I could account for all of our listens? And if I can't, then that means other people who are not me are listening, and that is fantastic. And so,
yeah, sure.
Granted, that's a pretty low bar to clear, but that's exciting. So, yeah, it's like, for example, I know for sure I can't count for any of our links from Germany or London or anything like that.
Yeah, true. So, shall we wrap up?
Yeah. Is there any other sort of big picture things you guys wanted to talk about with open science?
Yeah, open access. Do you guys have any insights into how you, you know, what you think open access and open science, how they work together?
Yeah. Yeah. So in general, I would say, I think open access is one facet of open science, and one crucial one that actually started the whole process, I think, thinking about this. And open source came basically for software, and now open data, and open, basically opening up your research, make it reproducible. I think all this fits together and is just making science better, and is actually going back to the root ideas, the cornerstone of proper science is actually openness and transparency, that you can reproduce something, that you can make the same conclusions, or that you think in a different direction, can take the data, can analyze in a different manner, and come to new insights, right? And I think it's just about increasing the quality of science by making it more accessible, and also making the results available to everybody, not only scientists, but basically the people who pay us. So as a scientist, basically the taxpayer who hopes to get better health, better education by funding our research. And I guess these are the different aspects that are initiated by the open access spirit, that are then spread to different parts of science.
Yeah, I definitely think there's great support for open science, especially among certain funders who are really, you know, kind of pushing for, you know, not just their supported authors to publish open access, but to make, right, you know, underlying data available and things like that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I see this more and more. And there's also, meanwhile, kind of a trend that the funders are looking at the different aspects and see how they can open this up or actually put incentives into the world that make scientists opening up their things, being it open access, being it open data, but also hopefully open source, that this is more enforced if something is funded by the state, that also the source code is available. So these kind of things are luckily increasingly addressed by policymakers. So this is a good trend, and this is, I guess, a result of a lot of work from the community. And this is also something I also would address, that years ago, I felt very alone with my opinion about openness in science. But meanwhile, I know so many people. I'm connected to the community. We have in Germany, we have a monthly call actually from the Open Science workshop. And this is found in other countries as well. And whoever feels kind of lonely or would like to get more active, I can really recommend look around. I'm pretty sure there are similar groups around for you, and you should just join them. And if there is none, please try to start your own, connect to people, and push in the same direction, making science more open, more accessible, more transparent.
Yeah, I think in this respect, indeed, open science is it's the other way around. Open science is the smaller aspect compared to open access. If we take open access not only as looking at the publication, at the scientific publication process, but in the real sense of the word, opening access to each and every facet within science, then this is the bigger picture indeed. Mm. And I think that is what we are also contributing to. I mean, opening up the way to this information and pointing it out to people, and because it's not our information, as is science is not somebody's what's the word, possess something, somebody's
possession. Yeah. Yeah. You don't own your science, basically, right? Yeah. Mm.
So this is something that each and everybody can participate in to help opening up the whole system. And I've personally never experienced a more open and a more polite community than this one, because everybody is really A, helpful, B, willing to help, and C, more than welcoming. So even if you're not really within science or whatever, everybody's what? Yeah, come on, join our call, join our meeting, join our workshop, do whatever you can. If you can help just translating stuff, it's fine. It's more than welcome. And this is really, really great to feel part of this community.
Oh, absolutely. Open science is awesome. And that's so cool that you guys are so involved and your listeners are so involved in opening up science.
And as you said already, I mean, there's whoever listens to this and has the urge to just start his own podcast, do it. Please do it.
Yeah, absolutely.
There's more it's than awesome. Enough room for more podcasts, even if you do the same topic, even if you have like, you feel like you do what everybody else is doing, just do it. There's always your own ideas or your own way of formulating ideas that hasn't been heard so far. And more discourse and more ideas on the table can't be something that hurts.
Absolutely. I totally agree. Mm-hmm. Start a podcast. I never thought that I would, and I'm so glad that I did.
And so if you want to do so, and you're not kind of in the mood, oh God, where do I have to start? Just ask somebody. Mm-hmm. Everybody that I know who has a podcast, who is blogging about this stuff, is willing to give away information where to look at and where to start and what to do and what maybe not to do. So reach out for help and you'll be helped, I think.
Yeah, absolutely.
Exactly.
You couldn't get, I don't think you could get a nicer group of people, to be honest.
Okay, guys. I think this was a really nice discussion. I really enjoyed this. And I hope the listeners found some aspects useful, or hopefully everything of that. I can highly recommend to listening to all the previous and future episodes of Plotcast. And, well, leave comments, spread the word, and as said, join the movement. And with this, I would thank you guys very much for your time. And I hope we meet soon again somewhere. I think Wikisite 2017, well, it's not yet planned, but maybe this might be a good reason again to meet, or something similar. It's Open Access Week very soon, so maybe also have a look at that, guys. And yeah, with this...
And so where can PlusCast listeners find you guys online?
It's, I think the easiest way is just Google Open Science Radio, and it should be somewhere there in the findings.
Oh, sure. Yeah. We'll definitely include the link in the show notes.
That's great.
Do you want to share your Twitter handles, maybe, if people want to follow you online?
Yeah, the Twitter handle that we have for the podcast is Open Sci Radio. And I think if you want to reach out to either one of us, it's either Konrad Förstner or Matthias Fromm.
All right. Thank you, Konrad and Matthias. Oh, yeah. And you can find us. We don't have a special Twitter account for PLOSCast, but I'm Elizabeth, and I'm a tweetotaler on Twitter. And Jenna Liu is Happy Seal.
And everybody finds her anyway, because PLOS is everywhere.
Right.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you, guys.
It was great talking to you.
It was great talking to you, too.
All right. Bye. Take care.
Bye.
All right.